I would personally like to begin with something about Oxford.
All right, yes.
But since we're here in Canberra, and you've been here now in 3 weeks, 3 weeks in Canberra.
6 weeks.
Six weeks already in Canberra.
Yes.
Maybe you want to, we should maybe begin with something about Canberra. What impressions is this, has this place made on you?
Well, I think we should begin, as I said just now, with something about my own misgivings about making films and making records of this kind of anybody who passes through, whatever their claims to the attention of posterity. Because it could be said that, in a very strict sense, they are impertinent. Namely, the reason a bloke comes here is because he's written something. And what he's written is there. And what he wishes to be known of himself is there in black and white.
Mm-hmm.
And that, so long as there's no general universal conflagration, will survive. And people can always read it.
Mm-hmm.
And people looking at his image may or may not think that he looks like the best kind of clothes model. And those who think he looks like a clothes model will tend to think the best of his work.
Mm?
And those who don't may tend to think equally improperly the more of his work.
Mm-hmm.
Now those, I think, are impertinent considerations.
Mm-hmm.
So I might be completely round and fuzzy and orange-coloured all over. It wouldn't make any difference to what's there in print.
Mm-hmm. But don't you see people communicating more than just through the written word? I mean, what about
communicating
and talking, with you?
Yeah, but we're not communicating. In the first place, you and I think so much alike that this is a highly fictitious exercise, that you're not going to be asking me any questions to which you don't know the answer in advance. And so it's not a communication in that sense. It's not a communication with anybody even 5 minutes from now,
mm-hmm.
because I'm not talking to them. Since the essence of a communication is you know to whom you're talking, and what is the point of talking in that particular way to that particular person on that occasion? That's communication.
But now
this isn't.
But if I were to probe you about the early days in Oxford, for which I'm still anxious to...
He's insistent.
Insistent, right.
Yes.
But if I were to probe you on those early days,
yes.
I'm certain I'd learn something that I haven't known before. I mean, this is a period that interests me a great deal.
All right.
All right?
Yes.
And
right.
That in front
yes.
of it, we might...
Why does it interest you so much?
Well, one imagines Oxford, say, in the early... When did you go up to Oxford? In the
48.
48?
Yeah.
48. Well, one imagines Oxford at that time as a kind of golden period. Very interesting people were there. Dumont was there already, wasn't he?
I think Dumont came rather later, about 1950 or something like that.
And Radcliffe Brown was still around?
I met Radcliffe Brown a few times, yes. He quite mm-hmm. often came.
But E.P. had taken over as professor...
Oh, yes, the year before I came up.
And you had, doing their studies at that time, you had... Bohannon?
Yes.
Both Bohannons.
Jim Bohannon was a lecturer. Yes.
And David Pocock was there?
Yes. I suppose he was already there as a student, mm-hmm. I think so.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And Beattie? Was he there?
The year after me, I think.
Uh-huh. And Mary Douglas?
She was there. Yes.
She was there? And Fred Bailey was there for a while?
That's right, yes.
Oh, and
yes,
who else?
Indeed. I haven't thought about those days for so long. Who else was there? Francis Huxley was there.
Francis Huxley. What was he? He was doing his... He had come back
from
the field? Or
he'd just done BSc. He was just off, I think, to the Uruguay.
Uh-huh.
It was a very tiny world, of course. I think you probably catalogued everyone who was around. If you remember, there's a print of the... what I think was called University Lodge, which was a tiny mock Gothic cottage fit for storing... gardeners and gardeners' tools in. There was more space for rakes and tools than there was for gardeners.
Mm-hmm.
And we were in the upper floor of that, underneath the eaves, practically.
Where was that located? Though?
That was on Parks Road.
Parks Road?
South Parks Road.
South Parks Road.
Opposite what is the entrance to Rhodes House.
Uh-huh.
And underneath was the beginnings of the organic chemistry department. So it was full of... it really looked like a Walt Disney depiction. You know, the Sorcerer's Apprentice,
yes?
Yes?
Yeah.
It was that sort of environment, with mullioned windows and Gothic arches and fake iron trimmings on the doors, things like that. And behind it, all the retorts and the tubes and steam and things bubbling and so on. And we had to make our way through that and then go upstairs. And we had this tiny set of rooms at the top.
Mm-hmm.
And there were about five or six of us there at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the many moves that social anthropology made in Oxford. And in each time, curiously enough, being shifted spatially from the prestigious centre
out to the outskirts,
out to the despised suburbs of the university. Yes.
Well, then, when did the move to Keble Road occur? You shared that with geography, didn't you?
We didn't share that with geography because it's part of a long, long terrace.
Mm-hmm.
So we have more or less an independent part to live in. It was next door to the house where Joyce Carey used to live, and we looked out over the university park.
Yeah.
So, and then southward on to Keble College, with its magnificent Fair Isle brickwork. But that was merely one stage in a successive series of moves
outwards.
And I think that expressed also the loss of esteem that the subject suffered.
Mm-hmm.
And when it started off in Oxford, I don't mean in 1884 when Tylor was the first professor really of anthropology, but in 1905 when the diploma in social anthropology was founded, it was founded at the instance of an enormously prestigious set of people led by T.H. Huxley and people of that kind, who said that anthropology was going to be the new greats. It was going to be a challenge to all former methods of studying civilization. And on the committee that established it, I think there was a professor from each one of the faculties of the day.
Mm-hmm.
Men of enormous scholarly renown. And as you know, the first reader in the social anthropology from, I think, 1910 was Marrett, who was the rector of Exeter.
Mm-hmm.
And we enjoyed enormous favor in those days. Tiny organization, but enormous favor. And as the organization increased in numbers and in independence, and in the end in efficacy, scholarly efficacy, so concomitantly its reputation within the university failed, that those great figures who had supported it tended to fall away, and bit by bit we became submerged under a sluggish wave of contumely and neglect, I think.
Well, let's go back to 1948.
Yeah. This is absolutely normal in a way, because I think it's a lesson of the development of universities that as a particular subject, particularly a relatively new one, acquires formal solidity and a substance in the form of buildings, and then of course the accretion of tenured posts and so on, so it tends to become inevitably bureaucratized and subject to negative publicity. And of course then there are other factors, but
okay, well let's go back to 1948. E.P. had just succeeded as professor. And who else was teaching there?
You're asking the wrong person in a way, because I really have a highly defective memory. I've sometimes claimed to have forgotten things and reported truly that I've forgotten them. And people have jumped up and down like characters in one of Dostoevsky's novels and said that you can't have forgotten that. Until I was rescued by my sons, who would say with innocent candor, but he forgets everything, So, let's see if I remember.
All right, E.P. E.P.
Yes.
was there, that one you went
to. Yes, yes, dark-haired,
yes.
Vigorous, looking, as everyone says, like another Welsh magician, rather like Lloyd George.
Uh-huh.
And he had something, too, I don't know about. Remember that Wittgenstein once castigated Norman Malcolm for talking about national character? And poor Norman Malcolm was in the doghouse for about a year and a half, having mentioned the possibility of national character, which Wittgenstein thought was a nucatory idea. Anyway, I think there may be something in it, because there's obviously a similarity between Lloyd George and between Evans Pritchard. They're both Welshmen, they both look Welsh, they had similar features. Actually, rather embarrassingly, Evans Pritchard had similar features to Radcliffe Brown.
Oh,
Brown
wasn't Welsh.
He wasn't Welsh, no.
Right.
That undermines what I was going to say, wasn't it?
Anyway,
there was this marked similarity between Lloyd George and Evans Pritchard. And in particular, this dark Celtic intelligence shining from their eyes, which is really just a form of trickiness, and a sort of hyper-acute curiosity, not diminished by any sort of scruple in the affairs of other people. And I think, obviously, in Lloyd George's case, it made him into a superb politician.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not the sort of thing one wants to be superb at, but he was.
Do you think that made E.P. into a superb
ethnographer? And I think it made him into a superb ethnographer.
Mm-hmm.
There's an almost prurient degree of curiosity that E.P. had in the doings of anybody at all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if you could discover, uncover, disclose anything about somebody that hadn't been known, particularly for something that the subject wished never to be known.
Hmm? He would work at finding it.
Oh, yes, he would work at it, and he'd be triumphant at having discovered it. Yes. He was intensely interested in human beings. Maliciously, some people said, but he was that interested, and I think the reflection of it is to be found in superb ethnography.
All right, now who did he bring to the Institute, or did he come to an Institute already formed by Radcliffe Brown?
No, Radcliffe Brown really didn't form anything. There was already, since 1914, at Oxford, what was called a Department of Social Anthropology. That was established at the instance of Rector Marriott, and that was what was in existence when Radcliffe Brown came. And he came with enormous ambition to found an honor school in social anthropology. He is tremendously, scientifically keen on the new form of comparative sociology. He was contemptuous of museum people, and apparently people like Balfour and extremely nice and hard-working men over at the Pitt Rivers Museum were very much put out to be, as it were, deliberately shunned on quasi-intellectual grounds, because they weren't true scientists of the kind that Radcliffe Brown took social anthropology to be. Anyway, when he came, there wasn't very much. There was this tiny hut, this little shack that we were in, the title, the Department of Social Anthropology, and his chief effect was to have the title changed to Institute on a number of grounds. Firstly, I think because he imagined it sounded rather grander than department, and in fact, it makes it sound only the more suspect and peripheral. And I once drew up a list of institutions in London which called themselves institutes, and they were institutes of psychotherapy, institutes of beauty care, institutes of traffic regulations, things of this kind. And so we simply dropped ourselves into that rather disrespectable company by changing the subject.
Well, did changing the name change the status of the place, or was it simply a name change?
It didn't change the status, because it had no statutory status, and it hasn't had really until a couple of years ago, when at least I procured some sort of statutory change. Anyway, when he came I think in 1936 or 7 I think it was, but then shortly afterwards the war began. I think he appointed Meyer Fortis to a position there. Franz Steiner came later, and I think there are only three or four students, including Bill Newell, who is now at Sydney, and Henricus, who I think is now back in the West Indies. And anyway, the war came. It was obviously coming very quickly. And when the war came, for some reason, Radcliffe Brown left Oxford and Britain and went away to Sao Paulo to represent British intellectual interests. And he stayed there until the war ended. By the time the war was over and he was back, the tenure of his chair was almost up. And E.P. was almost about to be elected into it. And so it's hard to see really that Radcliffe Brown had any effect on social anthropology in Oxford.
So then when E.P. came, Meyer Fortis was there.
Meyer Fortis
and
was there.
Steiner.
And Steiner was there, yes.
Now what happened to Steiner?
And Steiner was the man of whom Evans Pritchard said he was the most scholarly person in social anthropology. Wasn't saying very much from E.P. because he didn't think that most social anthropologists were scholars anyway. And as you know, he published once in Man the observation which didn't much please most of his colleagues, that most social anthropologists, if put onto the academic market in some subject other than anthropology, would never have got a university position. Either because they were too stupid or whatever. So there were very few people there.
All right, then who did he appoint then?
Well, he appointed Godfrey Leonhardt.
Godfrey Leonhardt.
Yes.
And that was...
Yeah.
Godfrey had done his field work by then.
No, he did that after I came up to Oxford, yes. And then afterwards, when Franz Steiner died of a heart attack, he appointed John Beattie to that position.
John Beattie,
yes. Yeah. And then he was chiefly instrumental in getting Godfrey Leonhardt's brother, Peter Leonhardt, appointed. Then Dumont, he attracted Dumont, which was a great thing. And one of the chief effects of that was not only to meet Dumont himself, an intensely scholarly man, very demanding, but also that Dumont introduced into Oxford a knowledge of Dumézil and I think nobody had heard of him.
Mm-hmm.
And recently, Dumont has published an article on the study of oppositions, on dual classification, in which he, I'm afraid, controverts Evans Pritchard about Hertz too. Because
mm-hmm.
Hertz, E.P. says in the introduction to Right and Left, that throughout his tenure of his chair at Oxford, he gave lectures on Hertz. And this was the beginning of an interest in these topics. And Dumont said that when he got there, in fact, E.P. had never heard of Hertz and hadn't read him.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no copy of Hertz in the library.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a conflict of recollection there.
But E.P. cites Hertz several times in Neuer Religion.
In Neuer Religion. But
and
that didn't come out till 56, after all.
Right. But we also have the Institute has E.P.'s copy of the Année Sociologique.
That was Radcliffe Brown's set.
That was Radcliffe Brown's
set. Radcliffe Brown's set, yes.
I see.
He has some of his marginalia in it, so
yes,
we know that he read parts of it, and
yes,
the sociology.
Yes, yes. Yes.
But anyway, the essential thing is that when Dumont came, he brought not only himself and his own ideas, but an increased concentration on the early sociology, particularly Hertz, and he introduced us to Dumézil. And no doubt we should have caught up with Dumézil later, but it might have taken years and years.
Taken years and years.
Yes.
Well, who was your supervisor then for your... Was Dumont have been involved with you?
He was my supervisor.
He was your supervisor?
Yes, he was, yes.
For your B-Lit?
And also Chaimu Srinivas, I'd forgotten about him.
Srinivas
was the lecturer in Indian sociology.
I see.
That's right.
And
yes.
He came when... E.P. appointed Srinivas, or he was there
E.P.,
from...
No,
Srinivas
was a student of Radcliffe Brown's.
Mm-hmm.
And he may or may not have been appointed by E.P.
Mm-hmm.
And then E.P. was my own supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
For a time. Not that he did much by supervision. I'm not saying he didn't read what I wrote. He may or may not have read it.
Mm-hmm.
But his, the only comment I can think of him saying was that I think there was a comma too many somewhere, or there ought to be a comma, you know.
Useful.
Yes.
Yes.
He was an odd man. You know that he used to say of ethnography that what really counted was not technicalities, or some sort of thoroughgoing program, a sort of Malinowski matrix in which you tick off the things you've done and not done, but you said impressions are the things that really count, just as they are the things that really count in responding to Tolstoy or something like that. And I think he used to get impressions also of theses. He examined two theses of mine, first my B-Lit and then my B-Phil. And did I say supervised or examined? Because he part supervised one, certainly.
No, he couldn't have been examiner.
He couldn't have been examiner.
Yeah.
But he examined me, I think, for both.
Mm-hmm.
That's right, he examined me for both.
Mm-hmm.
And so he did. The first time in company with Hammond Dalton, the second in company with Edmund Leach. And he gave me the definite impression by the questions he asked that he really hadn't read the thesis on either occasion. I'm sure he gained some impression of the thesis. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure he hadn't read it.
I might add that I had E.P. and Leach as my examiners on
yes.
my D-Phil.
Yes.
And I think, at least it seemed to me, that E.P. hadn't read beyond the first 20 pages of my thesis.
Yeah.
Certainly didn't
yes.
give it any impression of having read it. Whereas Leach was very thorough.
Oh,
he
yes.
went over the thesis.
Oh, indeed. Oh, yes.
He went over
yes.
the thesis in great
yes.
detail.
Yes. So. And Leach, I must say, was always, I mean, quite apart from his own intellectual verve, and the value of his works. To me, he was always tremendously important because I'd, as it were, dogged his footsteps in many ways. And he was in the Burma army. I was in the Indian army in Burma. He went to Sarawak. I followed him to Sarawak. And at every stage, he was tremendously important to me. I asked him once, how'd you get to Borneo? And so he typed out. On some rickety machine, he must have bought in some sort of Victorian auction. He typed out page after page of foolscap about how to get to Borneo, you know, and how to get some money, and when you've got some money, how to get it from A to B, and what you live on when you get there, and things of this kind.
Well, what made you decide to go to Borneo? I mean, you had
yeah.
previous interests in Burma.
Yes, yes.
Why did you decide on
well,
Borneo instead of Burma?
I had been as far south and east as Malaysia,
mm-hmm.
Singapore,
mm-hmm.
and to the east I've been as far as Cambodia. And I was completely committed to Southeast Asia. It was the
mm-hmm.
only form of the only frame of adult life that I'd ever known. Mm-hmm. I loved it. I couldn't conceive living a life anywhere else. But I wanted to see more of it. And Borneo was the next place, obviously, to go. Southeast, one of the obvious places to go. Well, one was tempted, one has to be tempted towards places like Bali, and my romantic inclination was to go there. But I knew very well, I'd been to the University of Leiden, and I knew before I went, and they certainly taught me after I'd been there, that you couldn't seriously work on Bali without a preparation in a literature going back to 1597 in Dutch, without some knowledge of Sanskrit, without a good command of Kawi to begin with, and then of course of modern Balinese. Mm-hmm. And it was quite clear that would take 5, 6, or 7 years to do, which I hadn't got. Mm-hmm. And so I had to go for very, very much the second best. And that was Borneo. But once again there were two romantic inclinations. In the first place, the pictures of the people published by Hose and MacDougall in the pagan tribes of Borneo showed them being tremendously handsome, beautifully built, light skin, high cheekbones, slanting eyes, long straight black hair, and so on. And I adored this, as I still do. And that was one of the chief reasons I went to Borneo. And then, of course, there was another romantic inclination, which was that in 1947, the man had gone out, I think, from the Field Museum at Chicago, looking for Penan, so-called Punan, in the middle of Borneo. And he'd come back and he published an article in the American Anthropologist saying they weren't any such people. It's a category mistake. Mm-hmm. That Punan were simply members of other tribes, real tribes, who wandered off into the forest for a time. And while they were there, they were called Punan. When they were back, they weren't. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was highly implausible, because I had about 100 or more references in the Dutch literature to these peoples, and they seemed to be real people. So I went there to see if they really did exist. That was the first, a romantic impulsion. And I think that's quite important, that it was a romantic impulsion, because, well, I think Evans Pritchard was certainly a romantic, and without listing other anthropologists, I think it could be claimed that those who in the end have made the most interesting, perhaps most lasting contributions, have been fundamentally romantics and not Radcliffe Brownian, quotes, scientists. They were not scientific, but they were pure-blooded romantics. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing incompatible between being a romantic, doing things for the sake of sensation or beauty, mm-hmm. or novel experience, whatever it may be, and doing something serious on the other hand. Mm-hmm. So those are the reasons I went there. Mm-hmm.
Well then, you came back to Oxford, what, in 52 or 53?
I came back at the end of 52, it was.
52.
Yes, yes.
And you immediately finished your... Then you took a year or...
I wrote it in the calendar year.
Calendar year thesis.
Yes. And then went off to Sumba. Yes.
Back to Sumba.
Yeah, directly back to Sumba.
And that
was a mistake. Looking back, that was obviously a mistake. Mortimer Wheeler, the archaeologist, has a precept which I gather he used to impose when he was director of the Archaeological Survey of India, that you never embarked on one piece of research until you've written up the previous one.
Mm.
So I think that was a mistake, but I wanted to get out again, and it was the only opportunity I had, in a way.
And was that also a romantic impulsion, to go off to Sumba? Or was
absolutely
that
not.
Motivated with...
No, it's a purely theoretical one. I was interested in what was in those days called circulating connubium, and I wanted to go and make the beginning of a study of circulating connubium there.
Uh-huh. But you also went back to Borneo at some point. I remember you telling that you went back to the Penan.
Briefly, I went back in 55, I think it was, and I went back to them for 4 or 5 months in 1958. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
So you've had two trips back to the Penan.
Yeah, yeah. I hated going back in 58 because the changes were already quite marked. The people were stopping to using the blowpipe. The number of shotguns that they had increased. In my day, they had practically none. They were beginning to wear more clothes, they were beginning to wear Malay types of ornaments to cover it. And, well, the moral contrast was the worst. I think not only the incipient signs of a sort of degradation spreading in, moral degradation spreading in the coast, but also one could see that the way people wear out. There's one lovely girl, for example, Jingin, who was about 16 years old when I was first there. And I saw her 6 years, whatever it was, 8 years later, and she looks as though she'd aged by about 15 or 20 years. Mm-hmm. And it's dreadful to see those. It's dreadful enough that such things happen, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a particular shock when you see them happen to people that you can't help. Like watching Everett Pritchard himself, for example, decline, as he did in his latter years, you see him decline physically and intellectually, and so deplorably as he did.
Certainly when I arrived in Oxford, E.P., and this was in 62, E.P. was already an old man.
Yes.
White hair.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. That happened quite quickly.
Well, you finished, you went off to Sumba. You came back to Sumba, then did you, were you appointed immediately to the Institute, or did you teach somewhere else?
I came back in 55 and almost immediately was offered a job, a temporary job, at the University of Illinois.
Oh.
Julian Stewart was going away for a semester, and friends of mine who were there, who was there? There was Edward Winter, and
Lou
Farren,
yes.
And I think, oh, Dick Downs was later, mm-hmm. but those two were there at any rate. And Chuck Erasmus, who now teaches at Santa Barbara, they were there, and they asked me to go there for that semester. Mm-hmm. And that was the beginning of a long love affair with the United States. Really.
Uh-huh.
It sounds a bit surprising to those who don't know the Midwest, you know.
Uh-huh.
But the University of Illinois, in spite of being in the middle of all the cornfields, you know, with the choruses of pigs, I'm making that up because you never heard of pig in Illinois. They're far too far away. But it was like being out in the Russian steppes. It really was. And the University of Illinois was exciting, too, in those mm-hmm. days, certainly,
mm-hmm.
because they were conscious of being isolated in the middle of the cornfields, and so they were determined to be a center of civilization, and that they were.
Mm-hmm.
It was bubbling with intellectual life. Concerts, recitals, the library was excellent, and all the rest of it. So, well, you were actually asking about appointments and so on. Well, then, during that time that I was there, I was given the chance to stay there,
mm-hmm.
which was very kind of me.
And you weren't tempted?
Well, it wasn't quite that simple, because there are other chances as well. I was offered then a lectureship at Oxford. There's a possibility of a lectureship at Cambridge. These were the palmy days,
mm-hmm.
you see, when almost anyone could get a job. And then there were two departments in London at which I could have had a job.
Mm-hmm.
So there were about five or six openings. And once again, I think being a romantic, as well as being, by inclination at any rate, a scholar, I forgot Harvard.
Oh.
I was offered a post at Harvard by Clyde Cluckholm.
Mm-hmm.
And so essentially the choice was not Illinois at all, but between going to Harvard and going back to Oxford.
Mm-hmm.
And being a romantic and being in many ways committed to an Oxford, which I was only just learning to understand. No one ever does, but I was learning to understand. I opted for Oxford. This may have had some effect on the, not only on my own work, but on the work that other people have done too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's conceivable, if you imagine some sort of Borges story, and what would have happened if I'd gone to Harvard instead of Oxford?
Mm-hmm.
I'd have been thrown out. George Homer would have had me slung out, you know, within two or three years. Something like that. Well, all the best people get, well, not all, but many of the best people get thrown out of Harvard. I should certainly have got thrown out of Harvard, best or not. But I should have been committed and happily committed to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And that might have had an effect on American anthropology.
Mm-hmm.
Or on the other hand, it might have got me out of anthropology,
mm-hmm.
which might have been happier for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you went back then, was EP instrumental in tempting you to come back to
yes.
Oxford?
Oh, of course, yes. Yes.
Yeah. And you also had the opportunity of being associated with Merton, which you've been...
Well, to go back, well,
go
I
back
always
to
did belong to Merton.
You always
yeah.
belonged to Merton.
Yes, yes, yes.
Well,
I'm glad you mentioned that, because it tends to be thought by some people who are resolutely anti-establishment, as they think, that these values, you know, the spirit of the regiment or attachment to the college and so on, belong to a bygone day, a privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And those people who were inspired by these sentiments really didn't deserve to have them. And the objects of the sentiments didn't deserve to be the object and so on. But in my own experience, that I'm not alone in thinking that the spirit of the regiment really does count intensely.
Mm-hmm.
And when you distinguish a good regiment from a bad one, a good battalion from a bad one, it's by its spirit that you distinguish it, not by its technical achievements.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have a technically efficient university, for example, in the margarine factory. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
But we happen at Oxford to have a superb system of colleges, and the colleges attract people's loyalties, and the loyalties conduce to excellent work.
Mm-hmm.
So these were all enormous factors in taking me back to Oxford and not diverting me to Harvard.
Mm-hmm. But I take it by implication then, the same spirit that pervades the colleges, you wouldn't say pervaded the Institute, or pervades the Institute.
I think it wasn't the feeling of comity, it wasn't quite the feeling of comity, because the Institute, from the very earliest days that I can recall it, was riven subliminally. I wasn't much allowed to show on the surface, but it was actually riven factionally on grounds of religious commitment and of sexual predilection and of lifestyle, by which I mean drinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah?
And that made an enormous divide mm-hmm. among those who were there.
Mm-hmm.
But on the intellectual score, it is quite true that for a few years, when E.P. was in his prime and vigorous and cared more about things of that kind than he later did, there was a conscience collective
mm-hmm.
in the Institute.
Now, let's pinpoint those
yeah.
years. When were they?
Well, they were roughly, I suppose, from the late 40s, certainly the early 50s,
mm-hmm.
and until perhaps around the year that E.P. published No Religion, 56, something like that. Yes, yeah. And
yeah, go ahead.
There are a number of factors, not all of which one can mention,
mm-hmm.
Intervene.
Mm-hmm.
What you've got to realize is that we're all focused intensely upon Evans Pritchard,
mm-hmm.
that whatever the word charismatic doesn't mean, or shouldn't mean, he was a charismatic figure.
Mm-hmm.
And he was essential to us, and we all congregated around him.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to explain to anybody afterwards.
I remember in 62,
mm.
there was the year of my diploma.
Yes.
It was probably the most exciting intellectual year
yes.
of my life.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was still E.P.'s way to go around the Institute about 11 o'clock.
Yes, yes.
To collect a following to go to one of the pubs.
Yes.
And the discussions, the heady discussions at the
yes.
pub,
mm.
and all guests, visitors,
yes.
would congregate there.
Yes.
And for a few hours, one
yeah.
one could get sparks or intimations
exactly.
of this incredible
yes.
vigor.
Yes, there were those days,
yeah.
even that day. Yes,
exactly.
Yes. I'm glad you find it so intellectually exciting, because the subject itself can be. It really can be. And I've seen it so often, year by year, with people who become intensely excited by searchlight anthropology, in a way that those who practice more parochial disciplines seldom experience and hardly believe of us.
Mm-hmm.
I can't be denied that on the whole we don't have a very good scholarly rating in universities.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, the possibility of anthropology still occupying the position that was envisioned for it
yes.
at the beginning
yes.
as a new grace or
yes.
as the,
yeah.
as a center for a liberal
mm.
liberal education, that's possible. But it recedes, you seem to imply.
I think it's receded. I think it's become less and less feasible,
mm-hmm.
certainly.
Is that also because of anthropology's dispersion of interests in so many? I mean, there's a variety of
I think the proper exploitation of its proper comprehension of interests.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And why is that?
That's not a dispersal.
Mm-hmm. Well, why is that?
Why is what? That we're doing the job more properly than we used to.
It's not a dispersal of interests.
No.
But you're failing of...
It's a more effective exploitation of the proper range of interests.
All right.
Mm.
That is what's happened.
Yeah.
All right.
Mm.
But then we've lost the centrality to the whole exercise.
In some people's view, we obviously have. There are some Manchester anthropologists, for example, who wouldn't agree with this. But I think that there is a centrality, which we find in the Année Sociologique, which we find in Christophe de Coulanges, which we find even in Comte. And that is a view of anthropology, let's say, as composing a kind of comparative epistemology.
Hmm? Mm-hmm. Rather than a comparative sociology.
Oh, yes, of course.
Yes.
Yes. Which I find a far more trivial
yeah.
And technical and, in the long run, in the outcome, boring
mm-hmm.
Undertaking.
Mm-hmm. All right. So
comparative sociology is fine in certain ways. For example, all these long series of prescriptive alliance systems that we've been putting out,
mm-hmm.
These are as dull as ditchwater to other people, technically fascinating to many of us. And if comparative sociology is anything, certainly, that's what it is.
Yeah.
And I think it's tremendously revealing. It's revealing not only technically, but by reference to the essential aims of comparative sociology, which is what are the essential impulsions of the form of social organization, and in some ways, more important, what are the constraints under which any form of social life has to operate.
But ultimately, even this this comparative sociology, this study of prescriptive alliance, leads to the questions of epistemology.
Oh yes, indeed. Yes. And to fundamentals of sociology and forms of the imagination. Mm-hmm. That's why prescriptive alliance is such a marvelous subject, a marvelous topic to work on. These are the simplest forms of social life that we know and that we can conceive. If we had to make up forms of social life, you couldn't think of anything more simple than the two-section system, for example.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
And then conjoined with this, you have all the interest of the analysis of opposites, dual symbolic classification of these fundamental repertories of primary symbols or whatever you call them, elementary symbols and so on. And the ways in which they cluster. And these are fundamental, I think, to an understanding of the forms of consciousness.
But
you can't do them, of course, without doing, first of all, the technical work which is involved in studying prescriptive alliance per se.
But as...
And only we can do it.
Right.
Sociologists can't do it. Historians don't do it.
But what are the futures? The future of even this study in anthropology. I mean, there are fewer and fewer examples of these these societies that we can study intact.
Yeah.
And where does one go then?
That's a very worrying question, because I think in the study of prescriptive alliance, we've reached the point that Tarte was at. He wrote a book on opposition in the end of the 19th century, in which he talks in the beginning about the disappointing game. Of collecting opposites. It's essentially disappointing because very soon you run out of the repertory of opposites to which people normally have recourse. Mm. And in studying prescriptive alliance systems, I think we've almost run the gamut of the technically and socially feasible forms of prescriptive systems.
So then what does the future hold? That's the question.
The future makes itself up as it goes along.